Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by one of our contributors, Ashanti Omkar. Hi!
Hello, hello!
Hello! So this week, Ashanti and I are rating Spielberg's Oscar-nominated fictional autobiography, The Fabelmans, Gerard Butler's actioner, Plane, documentary All the Beauty and the Bloodshed, and Horror Unwelcome. But before we get on to those, what else have you been watching this week, Ashanti?
I had a lovely event, actually, for the new Hulu show. It's a comedy called Extraordinary, already renewed into season two before season one even aired in the UK. And it has just hit Disney Plus. When I saw this, I got to see two episodes, laughed a lot, very smart comedy. And it was a bit of a love letter to kind of London. You know, you've got all the London landmarks, you saw the kind of diversity of London, you got to hear different accents of the dwellers of this area. You heard, you know, a lot of Irish accents, which I love that kind of, I like French and Irish accents, I found really sexy. So I really enjoy hearing those on screen. And so this one is really, really fabulous. I loved it. Very colorful, kind of reminiscent of things like Heroes, you know, where people are superheroes in real life. And this is all about a girl, like in kind of a lot of shows or a lot of films, they say, okay, what is the one person who doesn't have a superpower and how do they navigate life? And in this case, she's the one who doesn't know what her superpower is, and she goes out into the world, and she's, you know, she's just a very funny person. It makes for really fun viewing. It's like almost like a bit like Boys, but in a much more quirky, funny way. And of course, The Last of Us, I've been raving about it. It's just hit Sky and Now TV. Huge HBO offering from the game. And I mean, Pedro Pascal and Bella Ramsey coming together. It's just a magical combination. Pedro Pascal always makes fun of him being called the daddy because of The Mandalorian. And in this also, he takes on a daddy role to Bella Ramsey because he's protecting her in a world, in a dystopian future that has been plagued by a pandemic. And it is just absolutely brilliant. I've had a chance to see all of it. And all I can say is the best is yet to come.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I've been watching, obviously, the nominations that have been rolling out. Last week, we had BAFTA's nominations, which are often a good indicator of what we might see at the Oscars. And yesterday, we had the Oscar nominations. So there's some correlation between the two of them. They're sharing similarities with some categories, but not with others. What were you pleased to see nominated?
Well, the fact that Wakanda Forever is finally getting a spotlight has made me happy, especially with Angela Bassett. You know, it's like the first time a Marvel film has had this kind of spotlight. And of course, she gave the performance of a lifetime. I saw the film 5 times, I'm not ashamed to say. And part of it was because I couldn't forget the performances. I couldn't forget that underwater world that had been created in Wakanda Forever. So that was brilliant. Brian Tyree Henry, it was a surprise, a very pleasant surprise, because I felt like he has been doing the work, but he hasn't been recognized for it. So him getting that nomination was wonderful. Hong Chau getting the nomination there felt really good. And I was really happy to see, you know, some love for The Whale, actually, because I am on the heavier side and I have faced a lot of that kind of the fat shaming that does happen throughout many, many years of my life. So this film really kind of touched my heart in so many ways. And, you know, it was nice to see someone like Paul Mescal, again, an underdog in many ways, getting seen like this. And I hope that that'll give him much more of a spotlight. I was disappointed at the lack of women. And I was looking at, I mean, when I say the lack of women, it's in the big categories that we're not seeing them. So Michelle Yeoh, totally up there. Angela Bassett, we're seeing women of a certain age getting all of this. But it was quite disappointing for me to see that apparently in the 95-year history of the Academy Awards, 591 films were nominated for top prize for Best Picture. Only 18 of those were helmed by a woman director.
And there's no women in the director category for Oscars, certainly. Yes. Speaking of which, The Woman King, no real sign of that, which people thought might do well.
That was a snub for me. I felt it in my heart, Jane. Really did.
And No Till, which was also, you know, riding high on people's sort of assumptions of what might be there. There was nothing there. I personally as well, and was sad to see that Baz Luhrmann didn't get, and I know he's another man to add to the roster of directors, but I always find it really weird when all the heads of department of a film are nominated, but not the boss. he didn't get his nod, which I was a bit sad about because I, as you know, I love Elvis. And obviously, you know, I do think the right people have been nominated in the acting categories this year. You know, it's diverse. There's nobody in there that's really odd. I mean, one of the surprises that I think people have sort of talked about is Ana de Armas for Blonde. But I thought she was sensational in Blonde.
What she did in the film, I thought was one of the boldest things that anybody could have done. And I give her props for it.
Yeah. I also love that, you know, Marilyn Monroe and Elvis Presley are going to go to the Oscars. Maybe they, I hope they get photos of those two together. I wish they'd come in cosplay. That would be great. So note to Anna and Austin, just, you know, bust out those outfits and come as legends. That would be great. Okay, well, we should probably say that the first one out of the gate of those awards is the BAFTAs, and the EE BAFTA Film Awards will be broadcast on Sunday, the 19th of February at 7 p.m. on BBC One and iPlayer. So we've not got that long to wait. The Oscars are a little bit later, but plenty to talk about as we run up to that, as people ramp up their campaigns. Before we get to this week's big screen releases, of which some might be awards contenders, let's look at the small screen and Lockwood & Co., which is a new 8-part series that is on Netflix from today. It's adapted from the paranormal detective thriller book series by Jonathan Stroud, and it's set in an alternate London that's facing the problem, as they call it, of ghosts. At the centre are a trio of young ghost hunters, played by Ruby Stokes, Cameron Chapman and Ali Hadji Heshmati, who make up the titular agency and stumble upon increasingly sinister goings-on. Let's listen to what Joe Cornish had to say when Matt Matem sat down with him earlier this week.
My name's Lucy. I've ended up in an agency run by two boys.
My name's Lockwood. You need a ladder.
That's George. His weird mate with zero social skills.
You'd better tell her about the biscuit roll. She can't just go taking two at once. How about we find ourselves a ghost? I'm working with maniacs.
Let's talk about your new project, which is Netflix show Lockwood & Co., which is made by your production company, which you co-founded, Complete Fiction.
That's right. Myself, Edgar Wright, Naira Park, Rachel Pryor. We are Complete Fiction.
And so Lockwood & Co. is based on a series of books by Jonathan Stroud. How did it come to you? Did you discover the books? Did someone bring it to you and say they thought you'd be good at adapting this?
They did, yeah. Rachel Pryor, who is one of the members of Complete Fiction. I'm talking about us like we're some exciting band. She discovered the books about 10 years ago when there was only one book, The Screaming Staircase. And she thought they were brilliant. She showed that book to me. I thought it was brilliant, but the rights were snapped up by a Hollywood studio. Fast forward 10 years later, there are 5 books. The rights become available again. We call up the author, Jonathan Stroud. He's familiar with our work. We sweet talk him. We get the rights. We sweet talk Netflix. And here we are, 8 episodes, January the 27th, Netflix.
So what was it that appealed to you about adapting the books? And do you think that's the same thing that will appeal to viewers about watching it?
I think so. You know, I'm a big fan of supernatural movies and stories. And this book series has a really simple, really original hook, or a few of them, actually. The first is that ghosts kill you if they touch you, which is really clever and kind of obvious. And it's amazing no one has done it before. Because what can ghosts do? They can scare you, throw furniture at you, possess your kids. You know, even in Ghostbusters, you can point your proton pack at them and then they can throw food at you, but you never really get in a combat situation. So that's what's great about this book. And also the idea that that iron repels them, that salt burns them. All these fairly basic elements have a practical use against them. And then the third idea, which is kind of an old idea, is that young people are more sensitive to the supernatural. So combine those things and you have the kind of building blocks for this really clever world where the technological digital revolution has never happened, because suddenly everyone goes into smelting and salt mining in order to deal with this ghost epidemic. And then you have this kind of Dickensian situation where young people are employed by agencies run by adults and exploited in order to fight the ghosts. So it's a really clever premise, and it's a simple premise. It's not super complex. You know, our first episode just starts by following these two young people with these peculiar weapons into this haunted house. You kind of learn the methodology as you go along, rather than have some big exposition dump at the beginning. And the books are just really beautifully written, and the characters at the centre of it are really compulsive to me.
And how did you find it, having directed two features in the past, overseeing an 8-episode TV show like this?
You know, I treated my two episodes, I do the first episode and the last episode, so I treated those just like I was making a movie, and I was worried that maybe I wouldn't have the time or the resources, but, you know, Naira, my producer, is so brilliant, and it just felt exactly like making a film. Mm. The experience of then having these other two really wonderful directors, Will and Catherine, come on and do the other six was interesting in so much as I was able to come in after they'd shot and help shape their material in the way that producers would advise me on my material as a director. Mm. So it was kind of cool to be on the other side of the table, or wear the different hat or whatever metaphor you want to choose. And in the future, I think it'll make me a bit more objective about the stuff that I've shot. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Because when you actually stand there on the set, you always have a very firm intention for what you're doing. But in post, you might make it better by changing your intention. So maybe it'll make me more amenable to that kind of thing, if that makes sense.
And Lockwood & Co., like your films, has young protagonists. Is that something that you're just always drawn to?
Well, I think it's more of a coincidence. You know, Snow Crash, Section 6, I had a bunch of movies that I tried to get off the ground in between with that aren't kind of young people versus supernatural things, but those happen to have been the stories that have got going. You know, Attack the Block was just an idea that came to me organically because of an experience I had. Kitty Would Be King was an idea I had when I was about 12, that same age as the character in it. This is Jonathan Stroud's books that were kind of brought to me. So I'm worried about becoming known as the guy that like does those movies, because I hope there's more strings to my bow. But at the same time, it's a really enjoyable thing to do, because I'm not working necessarily with actors who have huge careers behind them and have experienced the process so many times that they might not find it new and exciting. There's always a sense of discovery and adventure and optimism and excitement on set every day if you're working with younger actors. But these guys are in their early 20s, so I don't want to talk to them like it's some sort of school outing.
But on that note, though, what is the trick when it comes to casting a young lead? Because obviously in Lockwood & Co., you've got a trio at the centre, really. Mm.
Well, there's no real science to it, really, or magic to it. People walk in and you say to yourself, would I believe this person has that character? And sometimes they share some of the traits of the character in real life. Sometimes you think they share those traits, but actually they're just doing a really, really good audition. Ruby Stokes, for instance, just did an amazing audition. I think the scene we auditioned her was the scene in episode one where she is actually auditioning for Lockwood, where she comes in and her psychic abilities are tested. And we just believed in that audition that she was emotionally connecting to the stories that she felt when holding these objects, you know. Cameron came in very early, but we kind of missed him. We didn't see how good he was. And then we got really close to the wire and we couldn't find him. So we went all the way back to the tapes from the beginning and we realized we'd sort of overlooked him. We brought him back in and he just was amazing. And then Ali was just brilliant from the off. So you're looking for people who can embody the characters, and then you're looking for people who you think can deal with the rigors of shooting, which are not to be underestimated.
And how important is it to sort of film them as part of that process? Because do you ever meet people that you think will be good, but then something just doesn't quite work when they're actually on screen?
Yeah, you've got to do, especially the energy between them, like something we did on Attack the Block. You just bring them back again and again and again. It's a bit, in Attack the Block, it was a bit like forming a boy band. Do you know what I mean? Like, so we'd bring them in different combinations and swap the roles around and just observe. And then you'd also observe when they weren't auditioning, whether they were getting on, whether they were friendly to each other, out of your sight kind of thing. So we did that on this as well. You do, you know, chemistry reads where you feel the energy between the characters. And in fact, Ruby was cast quite early on. So she would just tell us. We'd say, what do you think of him? She'd go, yeah, he was all right. What do you think of him? Oh, yeah, he was great. Like that. You know, the relationship between Lockwood and Lucy in particular is core to the show. So to have that sort of on-off I love you, I hate you energy was really important.
Did you have any films or shows that you used as sort of inspiration or reference points when it came to this?
Not really, you know. The thing about me, like you probably, is I've just watched so much stuff. You know, I've been watching movies like everyone since I was a tiny kid. I was going to the cinema on my own when I was 12. So my brain is just a huge melange of references. So I can never be specific. Sometimes I just catch myself doing something that is from another movie. I only realize afterwards, oh man, I got that from. So the answer is no. But you know, my favorite ghost movies are probably like Jack Clayton's The Innocents with Deborah Kerr, which is phenomenal. Oh, well, we don't want to get into this, but yeah, there's hundreds of them.
And in terms of directing, do you know what you're going to be doing next? Is it going to be Attack the Block 2, or is it going to be another series of this, or does it depend how
it depends. I got a bunch of stuff, you know, very, very nearly ready to go. We're developing Attack the Block at the moment, John Boyega and I. So we're still working on that. I've got a kind of very fun horror movie that I've got with Netflix in the US. And I'm adapting Mark Miller's comic book Starlight, which is really brilliant.
Shall we look at what we've got going this week then and see if there's anything, you know, there may be something in there this week that might be an Oscar contender. Shall we start with this one? It's time to look at Stephen's cinematic inspirations with this.
You dismiss what he does. It's playful or imaginative. You could afford to be a little encouraging.
She should have been a concert piano player. What she got in her heart is what you got.
You can't just love something, you also have to take care of it.
It's more important than your hobby.
Can you stop calling it a hobby?
So this is The Fablemans, Steven Spielberg's semi-autobiographical, fictionalized version of his life. Ashanti, tell us a bit more about this.
So this is what we would all class as a coming-of-age drama, and we are seeing quite a lot of these. And someone like Steven Spielberg has given us glimpses of his life through his other films. You know, we've seen the kind of mother character, we've seen the father character, and very strongly etched by him. But we never, I mean, I certainly did not know anything about his own life and what he had gone through. So getting to see this, you know, I love the fact that this is a drama where you actually see the small boy Spielberg and his love for film, how he gets his first video camera and how he starts staging things, you know, with his friends and with his school friends, etc. We get to see what his parents could have looked like, because obviously memories change over the years. I don't know whether he was keeping copious diaries from childhood, but what he has given us is a fabulous cast. I have to say Gabriel Abel as the 16-year-old son, as Samuel Fableman, is absolutely fabulous in this. Michelle Williams, we've always known she had talent, and in this one, I actually thought she'd be getting more awards recognition, which I have to say surprised me, because I thought that she would have been one of those they kind of grabbed for a lot of different things. This is John Williams' 53rd nomination at the Oscars, which felt really amazing, because what a score this film has. Paul Dano as Bert Fableman, Seth Rogen making a comeback in so many different ways in recent times as the best friend of this young Fableman's dad, who also is in love with his mom. And this is this love triangle that we get to see, and the magic of cinema in so many ways, because this little boy with his camera captures moments that weren't otherwise noticed in a real life setting. And again, that felt very much like, oh, wow, you know what? Cinema is a mirror to our world. And they brought that kind of story out in such, you know, such an in-depth and beautiful way. And this is one of those easy ones. You know it would get bankrolled. You'll know one of the best directors in the world has made this one. It's not like A Woman King that would struggle to actually get to that point. You know this is going to get lots of love at the Oscars. But at the same time, it's like this. There is a good reason why that is the case, because it is so exquisitely made in so many ways. Beautiful cinematography. And there's just a lot to love about this film, especially if you're if you love movies, and the fact that it's a film within a film within a film, because you get to see so many iterations of this boy's journey. I've got to say, without giving a spoiler, that the last scene is what might break you down into maybe into tears, just because you've loved Steven Spielberg for so long.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, he does call them the Fablemans, but to all intents and purposes, these are absolutely the Spielbergs. And it does make me wonder, I mean, I guess he had to have that step away and remove himself from the process in order to make the film. He couldn't make it so obviously about Spielberg. The events that are depicted here did happen. His parents, you know, did go through this breakup, and there was this very strong relationship that he had with his mother. I loved Michelle Williams in this. It's quite Marmite, her performance, because it's very heightened, isn't it? It's very almost Disney princess heightened. She's this absolute cinematic version of his mother, quite large and broadly played. But I found it absolutely mesmerizing. I thought she was wonderful in this, and she has been Oscar nominated for it. As you say, I really enjoyed the passion for film and where that began. And throughout this film, there's Easter eggs to Spielberg moments, kids on bikes riding around neighborhoods, Boy Scouts. You know, you're like, oh, Indiana Jones, oh, E.T. You're seeing Poltergeist, you know, all sorts of things you're seeing within this film. And it tells you so much about Spielberg as an artist as well as a person. But for me, I felt it was a little bit too long. And I could have probably done without the small boy bit at the beginning. I know you found that integral, that this was where the love started. But I've actually found him as a teenager far more interesting, because he's going through his sort of teenage machinations as an artist as well as a teenager. So I found that much more beguiling than the very first part. But yeah, as you say, there is this absolutely amazing end scene that is astonishing for the way the actor looks exactly like Spielberg, that you've seen pictures of him on the set of Jaws, but also with a guest cameo that's just genius. And it is the stuff of sort of Hollywood dreams. So if you are an aspiring filmmaker, I think this is so inspiring to watch, don't you?
Absolutely, 100%. I think it's a must-watch film for anybody who's a film buff, just to get those glimpses, because I think it's the way Spielberg has made this film. It has those very surreal type moments, exactly as you mentioned, Jane, that, you know, the mother figure does seem very kind of almost esoteric in many ways. She's floating through it. But at the same time, there's a lot of elements of realism that you see there, and the pain that a filmmaker goes through. And we know filmmakers, and we know what they've gone through. So it's one that I would highly recommend.
Yeah. And it's interesting, you sort of mentioned memory and the sort of prism of how you view your parents. And I love the details that he puts in. There are things that you would remember about your parents, like the way that her fingernails clacked on her piano when she played. And he keeps revisiting that. And it's very much a sort of theme of that character, that she has these very red painted nails that click-clack, click-clack when she plays piano. So things like that sort of attention to detail of how you feel thinking about nostalgia and your past and your childhood is really well captured. So, yeah, I mean, do we think then the Fablemans will be doing well in awards season? I'm not sure it will do that well at BAFTA, but I think obviously Oscar are going to love it.
Agreed totally. It's one of those where it has all the elements of a film that will win lots of Oscar awards. And, you know, knowing that the voter body or predictions or what we think the voter body will look at, this film ticks all the boxes.
Yes, indeed. Okay, so if you fancy The Fablemans, it is out in cinemas this Friday. And obviously, you know, it goes without saying, as a Spielberg film, it's probably best to see that on the big screen and not to wait, right?
Agreed. It's got a good theatrical window, so go out and see it on the big screen.
Okay, let's go for something completely different then. From one end of the gamut to the other, fasten your seatbelts. It's this.
Get them on board. Let's have a good flight. We're cutting right through the top of the storm. Listen, keep everybody in their seats. No exceptions, all right?
Getting everyone to have their seatbelts securely fastened.
Mayday. Real Blazer 119, we are dark.
Is anyone near? God damn it.
We're gonna hit.
So this is Plane, which does what it says on the tin. It does have a plane in it, doesn't it, Ashanti?
It does indeed.
It could have been called Knife, or Gerard or Island
or Gun.
But it's called Plane. Tell us what it's about.
I love that you said that. It does exactly what it says on the tin. This is an action thriller. It's Gerard Butler. I mean, when you go into a Jason Statham or a Gerard Butler film, you are not expecting Fablemans. You are going in to see action. And I was, you know, I was invited to a screening that had the whole immersive experience where they'd recreated, you know, an airport in the lobby of the cinema, and there was a departures board, and they had all the planey noises everywhere. And thankfully, I was saved from going into the D-Box screen where all the influencers went to see it, because I don't like the way the D-Box is that it's
good. I would have loved that. What are you talking about?
4DX, I should say. 4DX. D-Box is the old one.
I would have loved my seat to be tossing and turning as we went into a spiraling plane crash. That sounds amazing.
Oh, gosh, no, the thought of it, I just thought, thank God, I don't have, you know, 500,000 followers on TikTok, because if I had sat in that screening room and my seat was moving, I don't mind my seat moving, but not for a film like this, especially because you feel that turbulence, even in a normal screen, you feel it. I've got to say, I give it to them for sound design. I give it to them for that old school filmmaking, because you know, you've got Mike Coulter, who many of us have loved as Luke Cage in the Marvel universe, and we want to see more of him. And you know, him coming together as this kind of felon who's on this flight. And weirdly, this flight only has a handful of passengers
because it's New Year's Eve, isn't it? That's why there's so few people flying.
So few people, but at the same time, I would have thought, well, anyway, it is one of those where let's not think too much.
Ashanti, I feel like you're questioning far too much about this film, and the point of this film is to question nothing, right?
This is exactly it. Question nothing. Go in there, and you know this is Gerard Butler. You know what he does best. He has got that, again, I think, very kind of sexy Scottish accent, and he's looking pretty buff in this one. And here he is as a pilot. He has a daughter who loves him so much. He's trying to get back to his daughter, and that's his kind of major, his major goal at this point is that he's going to take these passengers, get them safely. At the last minute, he's been sprung with this prisoner who is also seated in this plane. And of course, things go wrong. There's a bad weather hit. The airline has given them a very bad flight path. And, you know, every issue, every bad thing that can happen, happens in this film. And it's about how Gerard Butler, with the help of Mike Coulter, kind of navigate all of this, especially because they have a kind of hostile landing on a very hostile island in the Philippines. And suddenly, you know, the rebels who control that island turn up. And let's just say that, you know, leave your brain at home. This film, it's, you know, it's like when I saw Death Race, there were moments where I shouldn't have laughed, but I laughed. And this gave me exactly that same thing. And I always say, I go to a Statham film because I know that, you know, I'm watching a lot of really serious movies, and sometimes I just need to get out of my head and see something that's fun, that I shouldn't be thinking too much about. And I just go there and see kind of good looking people on screen, you know, doing
smashing people with sledgehammers, you know,
but no blood is seen. This is the other interesting thing, is that they've kind of they're giving you this, saying, okay, your 15-year-old can see this. It doesn't matter there's all these deaths, because we're sanitizing it a little bit for you.
Yes.
And yeah, I mean, does what it says on the tin. It is a plane, lots to do with a plane. And yeah. Gerard Butler, full stop.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like we're sort of decrying it, but actually this is a lot of fun. It's, you know, 90 minutes. It's ridiculous. If you do start to question it, that's where it falls apart, because you're like, there's no way that could happen, but okay. And actually, you know, the scenes on the plane are actually the best bits for me. There's this incredible disastrous turbulence and then emergency landing sequence, which actually, like, they really will never be showing this film on flights, will they? You'll not get this in your onboard viewing. No spoilers, but there's a second sequence with the plane, which is also, you know, good. Bits in between, though, are just a bit daft, and, you know, lots of shooting and running around in jungles. But it's okay. It's fine, because you're just along for the ride. You are one of those passengers. You know, like, I have to say, though, that I'd like to know what accent Gerard Butler is going for in this. He starts out Scottish and then forgets that.
He does lapse.
It's all over the place. I'd like to know why you would be so ungrateful as a passenger if you had plane crashed and you were still walking, because those are the most ungrateful passengers in the world.
And also the women were negligible in this film. I mean, again, Gerard Butler, the center, every scene has to have him in it.
It's all about him. It's all about Jerry. And, you know, the goons on the island are just faceless goons who are just violent for the sake of it. They literally propel the plot because they're violent. They don't even bother trying to set up any political reasoning why they behave the way they do or motivation, nothing. It's just, these are just goons who just kill people willy-nilly. And that's what they're up against. It's as simple as that.
You know, it's wafer thin characters. You just don't need to think about them. Just go in there and say, I like Gerard Butler. I like how he sounds. You know, I like how he looks on screen. I'm going in this just for a fun ride.
Yeah. And, you know, if it probably might make you think again about making sure you do put your seatbelt on when they say on a plane, because there's some horrible consequences of not doing that. So I certainly won't be unfastening my seatbelt at any point on a flight. But good fun. Very good fun. A total popcorn movie.
Exactly. Take the popcorn, take your sweets and, you know, sit there, guzzle some, you know, fizzy drink and just go in for the ride.
Yes, indeed. Okay, so if you fancy a ride with Gerard Butler and his accent, Plane is out in cinemas this Friday. And actually, if they do have the wobbly seat option, go for it. I think that would be amazing.
You're a brave woman, Jane.
Okay, shall we move on to something entirely different again? It's time for some activism with this.
There's the Sackler family, you have the art world, the museum world, and philanthropy. And then there's the big pharma marketing and addiction and death.
My anger at the Sackler family, it's personal. When you think of the profit of people's pain, you can only be furious.
Nan said, I think we should take these people down. But do you think my career will implode? And I said, probably.
We need to demand that the Met Museum, the Louvre, the Tate refuse donations from the Sacklers and take down their name.
This is All the Beauty and the Bloodshed, which I saw at Venice Film Festival in September. It's quite the insight, isn't it, Ashanti? Tell us what this is about and who it follows.
This is a film that sheds light on the opioid kind of crisis in many ways, because people, let's be honest, pain is part of life. As you, every year you age and you know this. And you feel
a bit more
this.
Creaky, something aches, pull something goes somewhere else. You do need a painkiller.
Absolutely. And, you know, on Disney Plus's Dope Sick, which also looked at this Sackler family, this film is about Nan Goldin, an artist who got addicted. And, you know, a lot of this film reminds you that the Sackler family were very good at marketing. They were very good at being the big pharma. And OxyContin is something that made people feel better on a day-to-day basis, allowed them to get on with their daily lives, unfortunately also very addictive. And, you know, this, again, just like watching Dope Sick, it's almost the perfect companion piece to this film to get a bit of the background of how this whole, you know, crisis happened and how the Sackler family, everything that kind of happened with them. And, you know, Nan Goldin decided to try and fight. And fighting big pharma, as we know, is not easy at all. And then, of course, Nan Goldin also has this very interesting life story, you know, being a photographer, an activist, and also somebody who is putting a spotlight on the queer experience, the LGBTQIA+ community. And I thought that this film has the perfect name, All the Beauty and the Bloodshed, because the beauty is in the art. The bloodshed is what is going around the world. It's happening all the time. And, you know, it's interesting that I think it won, right? The top prize at Venice.
It won the Golden Lion. Well. Yes. So
which put a big spotlight on this film, because, you know, that kind of big award really does help a film like this. And Laura Poitras, I believe that is the pronunciation. I think it's lovely to see a woman director actually working with someone like Nan Goldin to create a documentary like this, where you're juxtaposing what's happening with Nan and her art with the actual literal pain of everything else that's going on with the crisis. And I have to say that it's a very artistic film, but it's not an art movie. It's a movie, it's a documentary that takes you into that life. And I would say it's one of the best warnings to be careful of the painkillers you take.
But it's also fascinating to, you know, we talk about greenwashing or whatever, that companies, you know, this is the Sacklers who, Purdue Pharma, who, as you mentioned, OxyContin is their big product. But obviously the Sacklers art wash their name in a way by donating to museums. So there's a Sackler Wing, there's, you know, the Sackler Museum. They put their name on art to sort of soften their image. And so it's really interesting to see that Nan wants to strip away that to show them for who they really are. And so a lot of her work is doing these incredible protests of people lying around on the steps of the Met with pill bottles all around them, or like throwing a load of pill bottles into fountains, or these sort of things. So what she's doing is she's rageful as well. I love her passion and her rage. She's angry about this, that this country profits so massively off addiction and pain. But the way that she does it is incredibly smart. It's actually thought-provoking. It's using art in a way to highlight other sort of things with art. And, you know, as we've seen in the past few years, art is incredibly complex in terms of the statues that we put up, the people we commemorate, the way that we reflect history through the way that we exhibit art. It's another factor to that that we've already sort of been in a conversation about with the news. It's a film that you just need to see to educate yourself. I knew nothing about any of this. And I was like, I'm really glad I saw this film, because I feel like I needed this information in my life, so that when I go to a museum, I'm fully aware of what I'm entering and what I'm endorsing and what I'm putting money into. But also, as you say, the opioid crisis is hugely important and is an absolute blight. And it's, as it's being reflected in other pieces of art like Dope Sick, etc., it's something that's coming more to people's understanding. And even things like, you know, Matthew Perry's recent autobiography, where he talked about his addiction, it's something that doesn't just happen to people in Hollywood. This is happening to ordinary people all over the world. And it's something that probably will be written about in history books as this silent killer and destructor of lives. So, yeah, for me, it feels like just a really important film to see.
Absolutely. And, you know, because of this, the PAIN is the advocacy group, Prescription Addiction Intervention Now, that Nan has championed in such a way. And, you know, thanks to them, the targeted museums have severed ties with the Sackler family. And Purdue Pharma has actually gone on to file for bankruptcy, so we know that this kind of activism does work. You know, it's not just people tweeting about this, but people doing this in real life. And this film gives you a glimpse to that in such a strong way, which is why I think it's just won and been nominated for so many awards. Definitely must watch.
It does inspire you if you feel that, you know, activism is pointless. What can you do? You're too small to sort of react against any huge company in any sphere. This really does inspire you that change can come if you join with other people and if you really go for it. So, even on that level, it's inspiring as well. A must see for me.
100%. I think everybody should see this film. Just like Jane, you hit the nail on the head. It's for personal education. It's a reminder. And for me, it the minute I saw this film, I was trying to avoid, because I have chronic illness. So sometimes you do need to turn to the painkiller, but you're saying, should I? What painkiller? What is the lowest dose I can use to get me through this day without getting addicted? Because it's just so easy to get addicted.
Yeah. Okay. So if you fancy a bit of All the Beauty and the Bloodshed, that is out in cinemas on Friday. So it's time now to go from activism and real life to something that very much isn't. It's this.
There is one thing I need to show you, and it's a little bit peculiar. Every evening before sunset, she'd leave a blood offering here.
Sorry, did you say blood?
For who?
For the Red Cats.
They'll need feeding. They'll be hungry.
So, Ashanti, this one is unwelcome. A little bit like Plane, in as much as it's a title that is like, okay, that's what that is about. Tell us who's unwelcome.
So from get-go, you feel that this one couple are just unwelcome in this world. Even though they seem like a lovely couple, Douglas Booth plays Jamie in this film, and his girlfriend, you know, that she's called Maya. Hannah John Comen plays this role. She finds out after a long time of trying that she's pregnant. And basically, just at the get-go, let's just say that they establish that this is a horror film. At the beginning, it's very much, you know, a real life horror film. And then it turns into this kind of the fable, the folk horror that happens because they leave London. And I won't tell you why, because it'll spoil the film for you from the start. But they leave London because this character of Jamie, Douglas Booth, has been given this massive house by his auntie. And it's in Ireland. So he's partially Irish. And they move to Ireland to this massive, massive, massive. It's like a mansion for two people.
Yeah.
It's very beautiful. It's very isolated. So that's where most horror films start, to be honest.
Yeah.
You move to a place that has like a wood around you.
Yeah. You're like around you. So Auntie left us a house. Does it have a creepy wood next to it? I think I'll sell that. I don't know if I want to move in there. Does it have a tiny gate at the end of the garden into said creepy wood? Maybe not. Let's Airbnb it, darling.
That's exactly it, you know. Of course, they venture boldly into this home, and that's when, let's just say that the fun starts or the horror starts. Both of these things, in the sense that John Wright has managed to give us, the director John Wright has given us a bit of both. You know, it's kind of his, I guess as a child, he loved Grimm's fairy tales, which a lot of us, when we were children, we didn't really think about how grim those really were. But as we got older, we were like, damn, this is a horror story that my mom read to me when I was a child. And I guess now this generation don't have to face some of the things we were subjected to as children, I'm sure. But this one is, it's a fantasy horror, I would say, in many ways. It's a film that I liked a lot about this film, actually, because I went in and, Jane, you know, I'm not big into horror, and I credit my horror journey totally to you. I'm going to say this
because
is...
Because I basically forced you to watch them.
Well, you...
Like a really horrible parent, I've made you face your fears.
You've encouraged me to watch them. And I have to say, I have come out the richer person for this because these are films I wouldn't normally seek out. You know, I am the sort of person that would have gone and looked for Plane or, I don't know, House Party. But instead, I'm watching films like Unwelcome, which, again, I feel that this is a very worthy film to be out there because, one, this female protagonist played by Hannah John Comen, she is absolutely fabulous in this. And though the film has so many incredulous elements to it, and just to say that, you know, this is a woman who will be in Thunderbolts and she was in Ant-Man and the Wasp. So we've seen her, glimpses of her in many ways, but we haven't really seen something that focuses on her. So this is a very woman-centric film because the guy she's with, you know, Douglas Booth plays this character really well because he is not a strong man at all in any way, but she is a very strong woman. And this kind of juxtaposition I thought was really, really brilliant, especially as she gets more and more pregnant and you see her with the big baby bump and what she's having to deal with is crazy things happening in this town. All I can say is at the very beginning, you are told that there are little people. In my head, I was thinking, you know, the little Lilliputs or tiny fairies.
Yeah.
But this is not, it's not what you would have thought at all. I sat there thinking, what are they going to look like? And then they start bringing them out at one point. And let's just say it will make you laugh a lot because there's lots of really funny bits of dialogue that you'll hear. But you'll also see that, you know, this character of Maya, you see the strength of a woman, but more so a strength of a mother And that, for me, I felt was very well encapsulated, surprisingly made by a man, because I wonder what this film would have been like if it was made by a woman, because, you know, I wonder how he had envisioned this character. And I'm seeing a lot of these films where I'm watching them thinking, this is a woman's experience a man is giving to us. What if a woman had made that film?
Well, indeed. I mean, it's sort of like the love child of Straw Dogs and The Dark Crystal, isn't it? It is about being unwelcome when you move somewhere and the locals being appalling. And that is in both London and in Ireland. And it's sort of similar to Plane, in as much as on the surface, it's quite silly and daft. And if you question some things that happen, you'd be like, well, that would never happen. And why are they not doing X, Y, and Z? But yeah, as you say, if you actually view it a little more deeply, which Plane does not have, it's about emasculation. It's about the anxiety of pregnancy and the lurid sort of ideas you have about what may come, little people. I mean, it literally is like the little person I'm about to have and the anxiety of little people and how horrific they could be. And also, you know, like it throws in a little bit of politics, you know, the English are always coming into Ireland and stealing stuff and maybe that's not okay. So there's a lot going on there. I didn't love it though. I could appreciate what they were doing, but I didn't kind of love it. By the time it got to a sort of red skies and bloodletting scene, it felt like it had gone completely over. But again, you can see what he's aiming for, and he is nodding. There's hat tips galore to films in this genre, in the folk horror genre. And then there's the idea of these little red caps, as you say. The red caps are not leprechauns. They're not cute little people who are sitting at the end of a rainbow with a pot of gold. The red caps are these sort of fearsome creatures. And often I think you would think a filmmaker wouldn't show them and it would be suggested, like Jaws, and the fear comes from the suggestion of them. But Wright just is like, nah, let's get puppets in. So you get these puppets that come in. And so if that is something that will break your suspension of disbelief, then this isn't the film for you. But if you kind of like a horrible little wizened red cap running around a kitchen with knives involved, then it's kind of a laugh, right?
It is. I mean, I was, you know, especially when you sit at critic screenings and many people are very stoic, you're sitting there thinking, should I laugh? Should I stifle my laughter at this point? Because it's very different sitting in Plane and people laughing at all these bits, you know. But at this, it was very, everyone was so quiet, but I was chuckling in myself. In fact, I watched House Party, another film that had a lot of chuckles. But the people around you, if they're not chuckling, you're sitting there thinking, oh, should I stifle?
Am I watching a different movie?
Yes. I did feel that. Thankfully, when I was watching Unwelcome, the one person next to me, Anton, he seemed to get that the funny bits that I thought were funny, which I quite liked. But you're right, Jane. I would agree with you 100% that I think by the third act, I feel like the director, John Wright, kind of lost his way a little bit. It's almost like he gave us that build up. And then, you know, he knew that he wanted to show us the power of a woman in a huge way, but he didn't quite segue from act two to act three in that right way. And I think that's where it potentially went wrong.
Yes, indeed. He thought, we've got to this stage and now we literally throw blood at the screen. I feel like with a different ending, and I have certain endings in mind, which I obviously won't go into here for spoilers, but with different endings, it could have been something like Men. It could have turned it into a really interesting comment about society and gender roles and, you know, colonialism and all sorts of things. But it decided to go on the just fully bloodshed route. And nothing wrong with that. You do you. But for
it's
me,
I would.
Yeah, exactly. And the genre that it's playing into and the history of that genre that it's playing into, it really does go down that line. So that's fine. It's just, I think it's, I would have preferred a different take. If you fancy a go with little people, little red cap people, then Unwelcome is in cinemas on Friday. So that's what we've got to play with. Which one is the film of the week?
It's a hard one, isn't it? Because how can you pick between The Fablemans and All the Beauty and the Bloodshed, in the sense that both of them are essential viewing? They're both very different. One is, you know, fiction based on real life. The other one is a pure documentary. And I personally don't know how to pick Jane. Help me.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's actually between three. Like, if you want to understand Spielberg a little bit more, which, you know, everybody has a soft spot for Spielberg, there's something in his canon of films that you must love. There's surely nobody. Is there anyone in the world who's like, I hate Spielberg? It's a question I don't know the answer to. And if you're interested in the Oscars race, that's probably a must see. I feel like All the Beauty and the Bloodshed is a just essential film to watch just for your own self-enrichment. But I think Plane is an essential film to see somebody making one of those kind of films really, really well. It ticks all of those boxes of that kind of film and is masses of fun. So why not see all three?
See all three because they will give you a different experience. You'll come out feeling very different after each one. And, yeah, you know, Plane, I did like those old school fights, you know, it's like Con Air, kind of film, you know. So yes, and Plane, I think, is one of those films that you can take your dad to.
Take anyone to Plane. You know, like, there's nobody going to go, I don't get this film. You know, it literally is Plane involves a plane. Plane goes down. That's all you need to know and all you need to be able to comprehend. And it's fine. So yeah, maybe the all rounder that's going to please most people is Plane.
You know what? I'm going to go with that. I'm going to go with that, Jane, because I have to say I came out of that film, you know, just feeling like, yeah, Gerard Butler. I know why I love him.
There you go. Gerard, you've got a fan. It's Plane, film of the week. It's at this point in the podcast, I probably should remind you that if you enjoy listening to us witter on about film, you can make your life easier just by pressing the subscribe button. And then that pod just comes in your inbox like magic and you don't have to do anything. So please subscribe now. And also, if you do like listening to filmmakers discuss their work, then we have a new podcast ready for you. Total Film's Last Picture Show is available this week, featuring Joe Cornish talking about his latest project. Seek that out now to find out more.
Okay, so the second film I will pick is going to be Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Because it is sort of weirdly a film about death and transcendence. When I first saw it, I think I was just amazed by the spectacle of it. But that shot when he walks into the spaceship, he stretches his arms out, doesn't he? And he's like twice the height of any of the little aliens, and they reach up and hold his arms, almost like a rock star, sort of being carried, crowd surfing into the ship. It's sort of terrifying and transcendent at the same time, isn't it? But when Spielberg talks about it now, he says, oh, I wouldn't write that ending now because as a family man, I wouldn't be able to leave my wife and child. Might be actually a fantasy for some fathers to get into a spaceship with a lot of children who appear to be able to look after themselves and go to another planet. I don't know.
For a couple of days at least.
For a couple of days, yeah, you would want to come back.
That's all we have time for, Ashanti. Before we go, though, we do have a listener's question, which I chose because it ties in very nicely to something we've discussed earlier. What is Steven Spielberg's best film?
I'm sure, Jane, you've predicted this already because you know me well. The Color Purple, for me, was one of those most important films that, again, you know, Alice Walker, her work was turned into this, you know, stunning film. Whoopi Goldberg and Oprah Winfrey, all of these, Danny Glover getting breakthrough roles in this film. Quincy Jones giving us that score. Very rarely where John Williams didn't score for it, you know. Steven Spielberg literally thought of everything when he created this film. And it was an extremely difficult story that he actually brought to screen in such a way that moved us all. And I think it's one of those most important stories. A lot of people would have read this book in school. But when Spielberg brings it to life, and this is why I say that nobody can say anything wrong about Spielberg, because he, you know, on one hand, he's giving us The Adventures of Tintin. He's giving us Jaws. I just cannot imagine what his mind is like for a man who can give us all this. And as a Tintin fan, as a child, we used to go to Sri Lanka on holidays when I lived in Nigeria. And my uncle had the whole collection. I'd read the Tintin books, seeing Spielberg bring Tintin to life in this fabulous kind of animation. And of course, before that, giving us Color Purple. For me, Color Purple is probably the one that I could most resonate with. It taught me so much. And those breakthrough performances, now we've seen those people go on to do so much more fabulous work. And because there I was mentioning how a man takes on a woman's story, But, you know, Spielberg, when he did it with Color Purple, I think he did it so well. So that's the film for me.
Mm-hmm. Mine is an obvious one, but it's the first film I ever saw on a big screen, E.T. And yeah. I had to be removed from the cinema by my mother because I was howling so loudly I was disturbing the other patrons. So I had to see the film again another week in order to get through to the end because it made me cry so much. And the trick, the magic of Spielberg is that happens every time I watch it. I've seen it so many times. It doesn't matter how many times I watch it. I think I can do it. I think I can sit there dry-eyed. And then the tears roll down. The performance he gets from Henry Thomas, the music, the score, that plant coming back to life. I mean, I'm tearing up thinking about it now. Like,
go home. You don't.
I'll be right here. Oh, my God. It's just incredible. And I think that's what he's so amazing at is pulling heartstrings, connecting you with emotions. And that's why he's one of the greatest directors ever, because he is constantly able to do that. He doesn't create things that are emotionally bum notes, that he manages to make that magical connection between audience and art that absolutely destroys you or uplifts you, and often both at the same time. So E.T. is the one for me. But if you have a favourite Spielberg, there's so many to choose from. Do let us know on Twitter. I mean, I don't know. You know, we're forgetting all of the, you know, Indiana Jones. Come on. Amazing. Oh, what about, yeah. You know, Schindler's List? Spielberg, he just makes everyone cry. That's my takeaway. So
exactly. I would say watch Fablemans and then go back and rewatch a lot of his films, just so that you know the gravitas of the body of work this man has given us. And that is why he's the GOAT, the greatest of all time.
Indeed. Okay. So on that note, we should probably say goodbye. So bid adieu, Ashanti, and we'll be back next week with more.
Cheerio.
Bye-bye.